So, welcome to the series of Locust Roundtable podcasts that is being recorded live at the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts. Today, I have a large group of people, relatively speaking, for a podcast. We have Cecilia Holland, Theodora Goss, Eileen Gunn, and Paul Park. So, everybody say hi.
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 And now you won't be able to tell anybody apart. So, Cecilia, why don't we start with you? We were talking a little bit about teaching.
Yes, I actually have a different kind of teaching gig than most people. I taught at Pelican Bay State Prison, and my students were lifers and murderers and rapists, and they were fabulous. They had all had stories. They all had plenty of time, and they did the work. Every week they came in with something to read, and they got better. And that was when I really understood what teaching this is about, which is simply getting them to read and to listen and to read some more and write and write and write, and they would get better.
Interesting. And Dora, your teaching experience?
Is completely different. Yeah, I think Cecilia wins. I've taught a variety of things. In terms of creative writing, I've taught at convention workshops, like WISCON, for example. I'm teaching again at WISCON this year. And then I've taught at the Alpha Writing Workshop for Young Writers, which is one of my favorite gigs in the world. And I'm going to be teaching at Odyssey this summer, but my full-time job is teaching academic writing at Boston University. So I teach a population of primarily college freshmen, kids who are coming to a large research university. They're coming, you know, in their freshman year, kind of discovering who they are, what they want to do with their lives. A lot of them actually are creative writers, and they come to me and they talk to me about creative writing, and my class is on fantasy. So I'm teaching them academic writing, but we're talking about fantasy a lot.
Cool. And Eileen?
I don't really teach very much, but I was on the board of directors of the Clarion West Workshop for 22 years. I just left that board to sort of retired from the board. And what we're interested at Clarion West is presenting a diversity of instructors. We have 6 weeks and 6 instructors. And to me, and there's 17 students, so you want to have at least one student that really strikes a spark. I mean, one instructor that strikes a spark in each student. And also you want to vary the instructor so that if someone is not on someone's wavelength, on a writer's wavelength, there is someone else that is. When I did attend Clarion West myself, and to me, the fact that each new instructor said the opposite of the one that had come before was really helpful, because it means you've got to figure it out for yourself. And I think there is an old saw about not being able to teach writing. There should be a saw about not being able to teach thinking, but that doesn't mean you don't go to school.
Doesn't mean you don't think.
Yeah.
And Paul?
I teach at a college called Williams College in Massachusetts, and I teach mostly not conventional creative writing classes. They're usually a combination of creative and critical writing classes, because my feeling going in, and this is sort of contrary to the prevailing winds of my department, is that they're really quite the same, or they can be thought of in quite the same way, and that learning one informs the other. And I also teach at genre workshops at Clarion. I've done that a number of times, that feels to me like a very different kind of experience and different kind of teaching than academic teaching.
Okay. We'll just throw it open. Cecilia, how did you get a job teaching at Pelican Bay State Prison?
I was the only one who would do it. But it was a wonderful experience. I wish I could do it again. You get a very diverse group, and they're very committed to the class, because, of course, the world outside the class is just hell. And so they got very tight. They were very good to each other. They were remarkably well-behaved for guys who had, like, slit other people's throats. And they did have a weird angle on the world, and it was a lot of fun. I loved it, and they taught me a tremendous amount.
Were they volunteers?
Oh yeah, no. They had to be good boys. They had to be, as they call them, say in the prison, they had to be programmable, and so they couldn't be, you know, have been reprimanded or anything like that.
Were any of them readers, or did they come from a
background?
They
all read. Oh, they all read. That was what was incredible. Of course, they have very little else to do. You hear about prisons that have, you know, TVs and tennis courts, but this is not one of those prisons. I don't think those prisons exist. This was a place where men are shut up in cells the size of large closets in the dark for, like, up to 20 hours a day. And they have nothing else to do, so they all read. And also, we had an excellent arts facilitator who just went the whole way, gave them movies and books, ran a library, you know, gave them art classes and guitar classes. We really had a wonderful program, and it was, of course, killed as California started to go down the tubes.
And that program probably was a reward for good behavior to participate in it.
Yeah, that was... the idea was that if you programmed, you got along. You went along to get along the way that... I'm interested in what you said about criticism and creative writing, because I agree with that. I think when you teach people to write good sentences, it frees them up to write their imaginations. But all you can really focus on is sentences and paragraphs. You can't tell them, you know, how to be imaginative, but they can find it if they have the craft.
Yeah, I mean... The way I started to get into this is I started teaching critical writing courses. I'd divide each class where would spend half the time talking about science fiction stories and half the time doing critical writing exercises or looking at critical essays that they had done. I found that useful partly because a lot of science fiction stories seem to be helpful for them in their critical writing because science fiction stories, more so than mainstream stories, often have an identifiable thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have a larger burden of exposition that is usually solved in a variety of quite complicated ways, and it was easy for them to see, well, if I'm writing critically, there's always a point where I have to tell people what's going on in some methodical way before I start to tell people what to think about it. That in some sense, and it also made, it was valuable for them to think that in a critical essay, you also need to think about indirect effects. It isn't just sort of surface effects of rational cause and effect that leads you to certain conclusions, but there was a whole range of other aesthetic effects that would affect the persuasiveness of your argument. Yeah. And you can see that more clearly in writing. It's as if writing often, the indirect effects are sort of on top, and down below, there's some kind of, causal or reasonable effect. But in an essay, it's sort of flipped over, and you have the causality on the top, but underneath, you have all kinds of indirect effects you can play with.
I wish I could do that, because they have an instinctive sense for how stories should go. And some of my examples, you know, we talk about sentence structure, and the thing I found most helpful in talking to them about sentence structure is saying that a sentence is a kind of mini story. A sentence tells a story. It has a character who is doing something, and this is the old kind of Williams-style exercise, talking about the character being the subject of the sentence and the action being the verb of the sentence. But we do that at the sentence level, and they see that a sentence is a mini-story. And then I talk about a paragraph sort of being a mini-story, and then your entire paper being a sort of story. It's an intellectual story. And they have an instinctive sense that Little Red Riding Hood goes into the forest and she confronts the wolf. But when they get to writing critical essays, all of that goes out the window, and you find that they're presenting information in a way that has no logical order because they don't think about presenting critical essays as stories that they're telling a reader. Whereas if they're telling a story, they're naturally thinking about stories that way. I wish we could do that. I wish they did that in more writing programs, and I'm sorry that ours is not structured in a way that we can do that.
Well, yeah, another problem is with my students, they come in and they don't have a sort of what's been squelched out of them is exactly what you say, the idea that you're telling a story to reach a certain kind of conclusion. And that instinctively means that they know that for a story to work, it's a timed release of information. So you have the information, you choose when to dole it out to get a certain effect. And, you know, lots of times the last piece of information that you put down is the thing that makes the whole pattern work. They know that about stories because everybody knows about stories. But they have been terrorized, and I can see it happening with my own children, to think that the way you write critical essays is according to a kind of a formal template that doesn't have anything to do with cause and effect, doesn't have anything to do with holding on to information to provide emphasis. It doesn't have anything to do with building to a climax. It doesn't have anything to do with a resolution that sort of takes you a little bit by surprise. It doesn't have anything to do with a feeling of misdirection at the end and all the kinds of things that storytellers do. It has to do with an organizational pattern that, you know, for me, it's never effective. Like, and when I read an essay of that type, I'm never convinced by it, and I'm never persuaded by it, because all of a sudden I can see, oh, well, here we are. We're at the end of the first paragraph. I bet there's going to be a really powerful sentence coming up. Oh, what do you know?
Thesis statement. Well, and I wonder, you mentioned that they have an instinctive feel for story when they're thinking that way, and of course we all grow up reading lots of stories, but I don't think that, especially at middle school, high school, that you end up reading a lot of really good, insightful criticism. You know,
the
structure of a high school class, even literature, is what? You read the book, and then the teacher lectures, and maybe you have some discussion. But you don't get to read somebody's review of the book or a critical essay that includes that book. So I think we have so many fewer examples to work from that you don't get an instinctive feel. I think I was lucky. For some reason, my parents brought me a book of Lewis Thomas essays, which are on science, not on literature.
Yeah,
but
the Medusa.
Yeah, and oh man, the way he could illuminate a subject, and it's all nonfiction, but I have to admit, I'm enjoying the term creative nonfiction to kind of grasp that aspect.
It's unfortunate, too, because most people who are writing real critical essays, scholarly essays to be read by other scholars, are writing things that are going to bore students to death. And in fact, they bore most people to death other than other scholars. And I get the sense sometimes that in academia there is a sense that that's a push to change that. And I hope it does change, because you have criticism that's kind of inaccessible to most people, and that includes criticism about science fiction and fantasy that I would love to be reading. And I'm glad I have scholarly training so I can read that stuff, but a lot of it is not very interesting. Stuff that's written by writers, Ursula Le Guin, for example, that stuff I don't hesitate giving my students because it's fabulous.
I'd say I've read a lot of essays, and I read a lot of them when I was growing up. And growing up, I wrote essays. I wrote long letters. I wrote schoolwork. I wrote, I made up my own magazines and newspaper sort of things, and wrote a lot of essays. I didn't write a lot of fiction. I didn't write any fiction, really, because I'd look at it and I'd say, well, this is really dumb. You know, so only two paragraphs in, and I'd put it away. And so for me, the change had to come to learn how to write fiction. Even though I read a lot of it, I'd never thought about it. But I knew how to start an essay. I knew how to grab somebody. I knew how to continue. That was pretty natural. When I went into college, I found that that approach didn't work for the English department that I was in. And if I wrote too interesting an essay, I was marked down for it. So I thought, you know, this isn't a place I want to be where I'm writing that kind of thing. So I've been a professional writer, but I've been in advertising and other kinds of writing, and that's where you're rewarded for maintaining the reader's interest. One thing that you learn in advertising, if nothing else, is that you're not paying anybody to read what you wrote. they have to reward what they have to get a reward out of it, other than being sold a piece of soap. And I've tried to take that attitude to the fiction that I write, that people have to be rewarded as they come along. They're not going to wait to the end. They're not going to read all the way to the end if they're not getting some kind of reward. And as you say, Dora, on a sentence-by-sentence level, you have to bring them along.
I worked in advertising, too.
Did you?
Yeah, I was a copywriter for a number of years. It's very good training, actually, for
it's also
can
be very destructive.
And
I think it works both ways, because you get to thinking, you become the slave of how you're writing, rather, and you're given the material. So when I first started writing fiction, after having been writing advertising for a long time, I'd always wanted to write fiction. I wanted that chance. But I sat down in front of the typewriter and I thought, what am I writing about? I don't know what I'm writing about. Nobody was giving me saying, okay, here's a computer, here's the characteristics of the computer, or here's a bank, here's the characteristics of the bank, here's the audience. I thought, who am I talking to? What do I want to say to them? And I still ask that question. I still have no idea who I'm talking to and what I want to say to them when I'm writing a story, as opposed to advertising, where I can sit down and, oh.
Yeah, because you know your demographic, you know everything.
Advertising, it's, I don't remember exactly how I got to this, but someone was talking about Nike ads, and I think it was a blog post I read, and it brought me to a kind of revelation about my own writing. And this came, more than anything else, from blogging, because when I'm blogging, I see not only how many comments I get, but how many hits I get, you know, who's responding. And there are blog posts where 200 people look at it, and there are blog posts where 600 people look at it. And I thought, well, what's the difference? And what I realized was that the difference was that the ones with a lot of hits were the ones that had some sort of takeaway. And this is where I started thinking about advertising. That when you have a Nike ad, nowadays that Nike ad does not describe the shoe. It basically talks about who you can become with Nike. It's about you, right? And I started thinking, well, what is it that my writing does? On one level, it entertains people, and people like to be entertained, and that's great. But there isn't that much of a takeaway from just being entertained. And then it informs people, and there's more takeaway from that. So if you can entertain them and inform them, that's even better. But then there's a kind of third level, which I called inspiration, and I'm not sure if that's the right way to think about it. But if you can entertain, inform, but also inspire people, if they can read something you've written, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and it affects them in some way, and there's some takeaway, they can take something of it and apply it to their own lives. Do something with it. Make them think about the world differently or themselves differently. That's the thing that people seem to respond to. So it'd be fascinating. I've never done anything with advertising, but I kind of felt like advertising, thinking about advertising, taught me that little tiny bit. But it taught me something about fiction writing that I'd never thought of before, because I never thought I was responsible for inspiring anything. And then I thought, well, actually, maybe I kind of am.
Well, there are different kinds of advertising, and I think all the kinds connect a little bit to different kinds of writing outside advertising. I mean, I had clients where it was strictly instructional or informational. Like the ads had to present reasons to buy this product, you know, like kitchenware or something like that. So there was a whole lot of exposition involved about the copper this and that and why it is that this was a better product than other products. But many, many products are not like that at all.
There's no difference.
There's no rational reason to buy this product rather than some other product. So you're working on a completely different level. Which is the level of sort of inspiration and resonance and you know, some kind of instinctive appeal, or choosing that you're going to position something for a certain marketplace where they're going to say, oh, I'm this kind of person, so I need this kind of brand.
That's what it is. It's to make them, to invite the reader in so he sees himself in the story.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
The thing that I do when I write advertising is ask the client what they want the reader to do, what they want, who the customer is, and what they want them to do. And a lot of advertising writers don't really get to that point, because a lot of times the client will say, oh, they want them to do this. That, you know, I want them to go into the bank and open a checking account. Sometimes you would think, well, that's pretty obvious. I want them to buy this product. But who is the customer? Why would they do that? You're motivating people to take an action. It's important to know what action they really want and whether that's a reasonable action to expect an ad to be responsible for. And the difference between that and fiction is I don't know what I want people to do when they read my story. I have no idea what they're going to do. As Dora was talking about online things, what I've found out online is the most popular things I've written are things that expand out larger than what I've written. Things with links in them, people can find out more information, it's additive, and things go viral when they do that. All of a sudden, people really want to get in there and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And a lot of online writing is directed at keeping people on the site, which is disappointing for them. What people want to do is go somewhere else on the web. Mm-hmm. And if you can help them do that in a structured way, which is what Boing Boing does, it's, you know, all of these, the blogs that simply are link, you know, interesting link kind of blogs do that in a big way. But if you can do it on your website, expand the topic that you're writing about in a way that allows people to go out and explore it elsewhere. People enjoy that.
Now, how can you do that in fiction? I mean, how do you...
I've been thinking about that. I think that's the big question. I think that will be a transformation to how fiction is written if we can figure out how to do that. That interactive fiction kind of thing that was big like 15 years ago has not taken off.
Yeah, it would be very hard to write. I was thinking of trying to write a novel like that once, and I got about a half a paragraph in. Not gonna happen.
Already to be.
I think one of the differences in this is that when you write the story and the reader finds the story, the reader and you don't know what you'll find in it. You discover it. And when you get the reader to discover something for himself in there, that's that power. It's that same power that he has when he can click on a link.
I think that stories are like that when, I mean, obviously stories are very different from blog posts and people expect different things from them, but when a story, I read stories that are very self-contained. I'm thinking of when I was young, of course, I had the same ambition that girls my age had growing up right around that point, which was that we all wanted to be dragon riders in Pern. But the Pern books are self-contained. They don't open up. Right? Whereas, you know, when I was reading The Hobbit, it's a book that opens up. It's a book that allows you to then go out and say, I want to look at languages, or I want to look at what exactly does it mean to be living in Middle Earth? What does Middle Earth mean? And later on in life, I found that that book, The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, had such resonance because then I was going and I was learning, you know, I was learning Old English. In my undergraduate program in English literature, and somehow or other those books kept resonating because there were bits and pieces of them that I was encountering in other literature, in Old English literature. Whereas the Pern books, they were great for a particular period in my life, but they didn't keep resonating through my life. So I think that literature actually does that in a much older way than blogs do, and they can do that, and it's when the book is, and this is not a good description, but it's open. The book feels open. It opens out onto the world, and you carry the book forward with you, and it affects how you read everything after that and how you interact with the world after that.
Good.
Yeah, I know. I've been reading a lot of short fiction over the last 3 or 4 years, both as a slush reader and as a reviewer, and it can be really hard for a short story to have that kind of impact, to have that kind of... because, you know, it is smaller, it needs to be fairly self-contained, but one of the differences of stories that really stick with me and versus stories that say, don't get out of the slush pile, are the ones that, especially right at the end, if they open up something, an idea or a universe or a world, versus the ones where they just close down, solve the mystery, you're done.
Well, you can see that in critical writing also, because certainly my students, when they come into a class, they've all been taught essentially not to do anything with their conclusions except sort of...
conclude.
Yeah, or, you know, restate some kind of idea. So the structure of the thing is, here's what I'm going to tell you. I'm telling it to you now. Are you listening? And in case you missed it, here it is again.
Yeah.
And there's something they know instinctively. This is a very self-defeating, circular feeling to it. But if you can get them to think about opening something up at the end, so that now that we have the information and we've been led through the essay in a certain way, now we can start use that to start to think about something that you don't even necessarily do anything but hint at. Mm-hmm. That can be a powerful conclusion, and it can work in stories also.
Kelly Link. Kelly Link's stories.
Huh.
Ted Chiang stories,
yes.
I carry them forward, and they change how I think about other things and also how I think about the possibilities of storytelling.
Maybe one of the great examples of this is the great Joyce story, which ends, you've gone through this whole party, and then you've had this terrible sort of breakdown between the husband and wife, and then in the last few sentences suddenly you realize the story isn't just about them, it's about Ireland, it's about the history of Ireland, it's the history of the world, it's just enormous, and it opens up, that's the great symbol, it opens up just enormously in those last few sentences, and yet you can't put your finger on how it does it. Mm-hmm. It's just snow is falling, falling all over Ireland, all over the living and the dead, and it's just
Yes, would that everyone in the slush pile could be James Joyce.
If only. Do you find your students are well prepared?
I never asked myself that question. Because I feel that there's, with a lot of my colleagues who don't teach writing on this level, or especially they teach upper level classes, and there's a kind of inherent complaint about it that the world is going to hell and people are stupider than they used to be and high schools are terrible and it feels to me that general sense is more about them than it is about these students. I feel that most of my students come into my classes with an instinctive sense of what good writing is that has almost been beaten out of them. And if you can figure out a way of reconnecting them with it, they can change in a month.
Yeah, yes.
If you say, listen, this thing that you think writing is, it's not that. You know what it is. Just do the thing that you mm-hmm. you would do if you had never gone to school. That part of it is discouraging. My worst. I teach a class for graduate students at an art history program. My worst writers are there,
mm-hmm.
And these are very well educated. They've all gone to good schools, but they think writing does something completely different from what everybody else thinks. It's a way of hiding yourself. It's a way of concealing what you really think and what you really feel.
That's what I was taught in school.
Don't let anybody know what you think, and they won't realize how stupid you are.
Well, exactly. You always have, and you have to, in terms of the ulterior effect of, like, say, you learn in advertising, the ulterior agenda of these particular essays is I'm going to tell you about something, but you know what? The main thing is I'm a little bit smarter than you are.
Right.
and that is an extremely off-putting way of writing. It doesn't really get any effect in terms of actually communicating, the truth of some idea that you care about.
I have a question for you that teach currently. One of the things that I found most useful when I went to Clarion, which was 30 years ago, was being able to edit other people's stories, do line edits, because a lot of the people at my Clarion were beginning writers, and I was not a beginning writer. I was older than most of the people, and I already had a career in advertising. I was a very precise writer, and it was extremely useful to see the kinds of mistakes that I could make done sort of in a larger canvas, and learn, okay, I write instinctively, but this is the class of things that I could be doing because I'm not paying attention. And then so you're helping somebody else by essentially line editing their manuscript. Sometimes you're helping them, sometimes they don't even look at it, but you're mostly helping yourself by learning, oh, that's why I don't do that, because if it's writ large, that's what happens. Do your students edit one another's work?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, they edit one another's work, and they learn a great deal from that. But I have to say, I don't think I've learned as much from anything as I have from having to teach writing. And I've learned so much from my students, and I realize, and I tell them this, I'm very upfront about it, I say, the writing problems that you have are no different from the writing problems the most senior professor at this university has, and I deal with the exact same things you do. I have more tools, and I have a larger vocabulary, and that's the difference between us. Because you're having difficulty expressing yourself clearly in sentences, so do I. You know, you're having difficulty putting your ideas on paper in the right order, well, so do I. And the writing problems are the same all the way up, which is a little depressing for them, but also, I think, somewhat helpful to know that they're the same problems. So I've learned a great deal from teaching writing, from line editing my students. In terms of what Paul was saying earlier, one thing that I've found is that some of my students come in with a significant amount of anger because they do instinctively know what good writing is, and they know that they haven't been taught it. And the worst is the students from Texas who are taught to write to the state exams. Mm. And they will come in and say, I'm from Texas. I was taught to write to the state exams. My writing is completely messed up. And they'll say that to me first thing, which is funny. But all of the other ones will say, we were taught to write. I would say, 60-70% of them will say, we were taught to write for the AP exam. And I realize that this is not necessarily how I need to write as a college student. So they know, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, they know they're being cheated.
Yeah, and they care. That's the funny thing.
I mean, people talk
about the fact that college students don't care. They really care about good writing.
Yeah, I think they're desperate to know anything authentic. And we live in a world in which there's so much, you know, copies of copies of copies that it's very hard to find the bedrock. And they know they're being, you know, cheated and channeled into something and molded and shaped, and they resent it.
And especially they're being diddled by these particular tests. Like I tell them, because they say this about the AP essay too, and I say, well, look at it from the point of view of the people who are grading these essays, working for $10 an hour and having to look at, you know, 50 of them in a day to get through anything. They are not grading these in terms of logical progressions of thought and whether it's an interesting idea that is demonstrated and drawn through to a conclusion at the end. They have a template. They want to see that the essay follows a certain kind of hour-shaped pattern because that's really all they have time to look for.
The five-paragraph essay.
Yeah. So it's not their fault. It's just that there's something fundamentally flawed about trying to teach writing in this particular way.
Well, it's a standardized. We live in a standardized society. Everything's standardized. Everything's the same size. Everything you're supposed to fit into a particular niche. But writing is about not doing that at all. It's about not standardizing. It's about unique and experience that just is not. Is irreducible, and that's why it fights this whole issue. But it's also very liberating for them. I taught a few high school students in my time, and they weren't anywhere near as good as the inmates because they didn't do the work. But they were. I remember how hungry they were. They were just so hungry for power, and for craft, and for. You know, something coming back, and they weren't getting it.
I think the best high school students actually tell their students, you know, there's a level on which this is silly what you're doing. You have to wait till college. You have to wait before you get to do what you think writing really should do.
Why should they have to wait?
Well, I'm not saying is the reason they have to is because they have these standardized tests that they have to teach to. But a lot of people come to my classes and say, okay, my revered Mr. Dodds or Miss so-and-so in my high school told me that sotto voce, really, this is not what writing is, what you've learned how to do. There'll be a point where you'll realize that in the real world, nobody writes like this. There is no professional writer, any writer at all, who writes like this. In fact, they write another way entirely, yeah. And it's a way that you know instinctively in your heart will be the way that you know you follow. And that, again, that's a tremendous piece of liberation. If there's any benefit to the way writing is taught, is that it builds up a certain kind of pressure, especially in the best students, where they're so frustrated and angry by the time they come to college that they explode, yeah. And they're willing to try anything.
Yeah. Well, what it did for me, and I felt that I went to a Catholic high school, and if I wrote what I wanted to write about in 1962, I was punished for that. I was held up as an example to the class as someone who did not have the right attitude. And this is true, and it's not funny, really.
It's
exasperating to be held personally responsible. When I wasn't intending to bug anybody, I was simply writing about something that I felt. By the time I got to college, I felt that I did not want to take any writing classes at all. I majored in history because the English department was all nuns. I did not want to have anything to do with nuns. I didn't want to have anything to do with having nuns tell me how to write. Mm. And there are plenty of good nuns out there. I don't mean to insult nuns, but I didn't want them teaching me how to write. Yeah, there are a lot of nuns out there. I don't want to make them feel bad.
All the nuns.
But I just decided I was not going to have other people tell me how to write. And I suffered from that. I could have been writing for those 4 years. Mm. I could have been writing fiction. I could have been writing essays. I was writing essays because I was in history, but it turned me off from studying.
So, you know, what you said, Eileen, just points out to me something that, to be honest, I hadn't thought about before, because it's actually a fairly scary thought if you're a teacher. There's a real danger in writing classes and writing workshops. And I have to admit, I took several poetry writing classes at the University of Virginia because I was a poet first, and I, you know, I wrote poetry when I was 12. I still have some of it. I wouldn't show it to anyone. But and as a teenager, you know, all my boyfriends have poems written about them. But it completely turned me off poetry writing. And to be honest, I think it's what those undergraduate poetry writing classes were what made me decide never to get an MFA. And they probably set my writing career back quite a bit. And that's kind of horrible, actually, if you think about it. And so it makes me think, and I haven't thought deeply about this, again, because I think it's a scary thought, that you can kind of mess people up.
Yes.
In writing workshops. And I hope I haven't done that to anybody. If I have, boy, I'm sorry.
Well, I was messed up, but the only writing class that I took in college was a senior honors workshop, and that I got into by submitting a piece of my writing. Everybody else had been studying with this teacher all along. It gave me 2 years of writer's block because the teacher wanted someone who had taken an Atlantic First Award, and that's a very specific kind of writing. And there were only 7 of us, and she had to pick the one that was going to deliver that. There was somebody who could have, and she managed to discourage her too. She really hasn't been a writer since. But in being involved with Clarion West, I wanted to make sure that that didn't happen to other people. And the way it doesn't happen is to have a variety of instructors. Also, as we were talking about earlier before we came here, having at least one instructor that talks to people that are not great speakers, people who sit by themselves and write and don't talk and aren't lively and aren't entertaining. Those people can be really great, entertaining, and lively writers. And they need to have an example. They need to see that they can do that. And they also... students need to know that one person's opinion is not everybody's opinion.
But still, some people come out of a workshop like Clarion and it's hard for them to write after that.
Yeah. It's pretty probably more the rule. I think they're processing.
Yeah.
Mm. It's interesting, though, when you talk about picking the instructors. I'd never thought about this because I've never been involved with something like Clarion, but but we had a real mix when I was at Clarion. And I never thought about the fact that there was a kind of deliberate mixing, even of personalities. I mean, we had Jim Kelly and Kelly Link and Steve Barnes, and they're all very gregarious people. They have very different perspectives. But it's interesting to think that you might actually want to pick somebody who isn't the person who's going to be socializing every single night, to sort of give students the idea that you don't have to do that. That's not, there's no one way of being a writer.
And of course, that kind of a person does not make a very outgoing teacher. So you don't want an entire workshop full of introverts.
Right.
Mostly, the students respond better to extroverts. I just think that, you don't want to discourage the introvert writer, because often they're very powerful writers.
It is stunning to me, the more I've realized how important role models are. And, I mean, we're such monkey-see-monkey-do creatures, and so few of us are sui generis that, you know, in my own career as a science person who's a woman who's also interested in literature and the arts and stuff like that, finding role models has been a bit of a challenge. And, I look at I hope that women coming up, you know, who are younger than me are having a little bit better time of it, but... It took me a long time to find my path in life, just because I was sort of navigating these different role models that didn't all quite fit, and so I felt like I didn't quite fit. And being able to be exposed to that huge, you know, variety of, well, some people write like this, and some people write in a completely different way, and it works. You find the thing that works for you, but if you get to see those examples...
I think Octavia Butler was a pretty internalized person. She preferred to be by herself. And yet she taught Clarion West, I think, 4 times. And she made herself teach. I once asked her, after seeing her teach and seeing her speak at bookstore, I was driving her around, and I said, "You've changed. How you didn't used to talk." You know? And she said she took a Dale Carnegie course. She decided that she had to learn how to talk for other people, for other writers, the introvert writers, and which I thought was really a remarkable thing to do.
Yeah, one of the things you try to do as a teacher, I mean, it starts out instinctive, and then you, like a lot of things in writing, then you realize it's working, and then, you know, exaggerate it, is you want to provide some kind of model as to how to navigate the world, and you know that that's not going to resonate with everybody, but even if a lot of people reject it, that also is providing a model. And if in a workshop like Clarion, if you can provide a series of models, that, and hope that each, you know, one of those people is going to connect in some way, there's going to be some resonance of recognition with each student, then that's a powerful workshop.
I had when I got into college, I thought that the things I was supposed to write were these sort of standard stories, and I wrote them. I was taking a creative writing course from Bill Meredith, as a matter of fact, and I wrote a couple of stories, and he came to me and he said, "Okay, what are you really writing?" And of course I was writing a novel too, but I didn't think that was what I was supposed to be doing, and I started showing him the novel. That was Firedrake, the first book. So he really, what he said to me was, do what you want to do and not what they tell you to do, and it was just absolutely liberating. But I went to a college that was, at the time anyway, extremely liberating. And
so. What college was it?
Connecticut College.
Oh.
I don't know what it is now, but it was then wonderful.
You know what's really helped me, and this has to do with the way we're all getting information nowadays, hearing about what other writers are doing and why they're doing it. So, for example, I started following Catherine Valente's blog, and she's a friend of mine, and so I heard from her, to a certain extent, kind of personally what was going on with her writing, but just following her blog and seeing what she was doing. And the same thing with Nnedi Okorafor, who was a Clarion classmate of mine. I'm very proud of the fact that I knew her way back when, before she published anything. And being able in that way to look at what other writers are doing and how they're doing it has been enormously helpful, because I look at the generation of writers I grew up on, like, you know, Patricia MacKillop. Now, I have to admit, I know she's here, and I'm sure she's a very nice woman, but to me, Patricia MacKillop will never be a human being. She's like a writer goddess, right? I mean, I worship and fall down before Patricia MacKillop. Terry Winling, who also I know, but, you know, they're like, they're these icons. But we didn't have all this information online when I was growing up and I was reading their writing. And I didn't know how they did it. I thought it was just magical. They were just naturally writers, and so people came and published their stuff, and the books appeared in the bookstores. And having information on how people are doing it and having them write about it is enormously helpful to me. And I see the other contingent that's here now are the Young Alpha students and the Dell finalists. And I think they are so much more informed than I ever was about writing, about the publishing industry, and it's sort of amazing to see. And part of it, I think, is having people out there who are talking about their writing and talking about publishing and all of this stuff. They have so much more information.
Who mentored you?
Who mentored me? That's a good question. Really, my peers mentored me.
Yeah.
So William Gibson was a huge help. Bill gave me the secret of writing, which was really important. He was the guest of honor at ArmadilloCon one year, and I went to ArmadilloCon, caught up with him. He's a friend. And he said, oh, quick, I've got to tell you, I discovered the secret of writing. And he said, come into the bar, I'll tell you. We sit in the bar and have a beer. And we chat about our lives and stuff, and didn't get to the secret of writing. But he was the guest of honor, and they came and dragged him off before he could tell me the secret of writing. And I thought he was kidding anyway. And 2 weeks later, I get a phone call, and it's Bill. He said, I forgot to tell you the secret of writing. I said, all right, what's the secret of writing? You must learn to overcome your very natural and appropriate revulsion for your own work. And I thought, well, if Bill can say that, then I can work on it. Yeah. You know, if he can look at his own work and understand that statement as the secret, then I don't have any right to be bitching and moaning.
Peter Straub said something a couple of days ago, relative to Emma and this tremendous thing that's happened with her. He said, now she has the ups and downs and the agony. And I realized, it isn't just me. Everybody has this agony. And that was very, very comforting to me. And I think that's what you mean, you know.
That, by the way, should probably be part of the title of the podcast, or some sort of description. Eileen Gunn reveals the secret of writing.
Absolutely. I'll put that in the summary text. Okay, here are the things we talked about. We talked about teaching and learning, and the secret of writing is in this podcast.
It's Gibson's secret. It's not my secret.
Okay, but actually, if we want to wrap up there, that way everyone will be able to get back to panel sessions and paper sessions and back to the bar. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to thank you all so much for coming, and I did want to go around once and let everyone say if there's anything they've got coming out this year, anything they'd like to promote, to make sure that everyone knows about what's going on. Cecilia?
I have a novel in June called The King's Witch, which is about Richard the Lionhearted, the Third Crusade, and is fiction.
Okay, Dora?
Oh, gosh. I have a couple short stories coming out, and one project I think I'm allowed to talk about. So I have a story coming out called Christopher Raven in an anthology called Ghost by Gaslight, which is edited by Nick Gevers and Jack Dan, which is going to be very, very cool, a wonderful collection of short stories. About Victorian ghosts of all sorts.
I've got a story in that.
Do you?
Yeah.
Cool.
I love the title.
And the thing I'm working on right now is actually, it's for Quirk Books. They do very cool, interesting books. And it's a book we're calling it the accordion book. because we're not quite sure exactly what the final title is going to be yet, but it's a love story told from the perspective of the two people who are in the love story, and you're going to be able to read the book in two ways. One way you're going to read one love story, the other way you're going to read the other love story, so you're going to get both perspectives, but you find out if you read both stories that the story is actually larger than either of the individual stories, that there's more going on than you get from reading the individual stories. I've never done anything like this. It's super cool. I'm in the middle of working on it, and I'm very, very excited about how it's going to come out.
Interesting.
That sounds wonderful, Dora. It sounds like a meta collaboration. Yeah. I have a story up on Tor.com, a sort of wacky Christmas tale that I wrote with Michael Swanwick. And then right now I'm finishing up editing, I'm guest editing an issue of Flurb, which is Rudy Rucker's personal zine, I guess, his science fiction magazine on the web at Flurb.com. And I'm extremely excited about that. There's like three stories from some really wonderful Mexican writers. There are some very promising new people that I'd never heard of before who wrote fantastic things. And there's some old favorites, people that, you know, I'm not going to mention any names, because if I mention one, I'll have to mention all, and there's a dozen stories. But I'm really thrilled to be able to present these stories.
And Paul?
I have a couple of stories coming out in anthologies, the one that Dora mentioned. I have a novella that came out last year that is in FNSF that I'm turning into a larger project. The first part of it is going to be it's a sort of a metafictional family history novella. And the first part of it is being published as a standalone novella by PS and a kind of expanded illustrated version with photographs and a kind of a metafictional forward and afterward and metafictional jacket copy. But I'm also expanding that project with a series of kind of interlocking metafictional novellas. And the other thing I'm doing is a kind of a birthday present for my kid as I'm writing a Forgotten Realms Dungeons & Dragons tie-in.
Nice.
Awesome. Can I just mention, I think Sheila Williams would kill me. I completely forgot to say that I have a story coming out in Asimov's called Pug. And so this is the Sheila Williams Please Do Not Kill Me addendum.
Yes. We do like to give editors their due. So anyway, thank you all for coming. And this podcast will hopefully be online in a week or so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.